If you were seated at a piano, which would be more fun, performing for Queen Elizabeth or backing up Aretha Franklin? With us today, former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice on Queen Elizabeth, the Queen of Soul, and the State of the World. Uncommon Knowledge, now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. Be sure to visit us at our website, by the way, hoover.org/UK. hoover.org/UK. A former provost of Stanford University, Condoleezza Rice served during George H.W. Bush's administration as a Soviet expert on the National Security Council and during George W. Bush's first term as National Security Advisor. Then, during George W. Bush's second term, as the nation's 66th Secretary of State. Now back at Stanford and a fellow at the Hoover Institution, Dr. Rice has written a number of books, most recently, No Higher Honor, A Memoir of My Years in Washington. Secretary Rice, welcome.
Pleasure to be with you.
Queen Elizabeth or Aretha Franklin?
Very different experiences, I'd have to say. But I loved doing both. And Aretha Franklin knows what she's doing. She didn't really need me on the piano, but it was great fun anyway.
Segment one, Iraq. What did you believe to be true about American foreign policy on September 12th, 2011, that you did not on September 10th?
On September 12th, we suddenly realized that the United States was not just vulnerable, but vulnerable to a terrorist network, stateless network, that had come out of a failed state called Afghanistan and had probably used maybe $300,000 to blow a hole in the Pentagon and bring down the Twin Towers. It completely changes your concept of physical security. And suddenly we had to worry about the protection of the homeland from disasters like 9/11, but in many ways for us the most vexing possibility was that you could have 9/11 on a grander scale with weapons of mass destruction.
So as of September 12th, you mentioned physical security. At that point, you mentioned in No Higher Honor that the one time you raised your voice to the President of the United States was when he was in Florida. He'd just been informed of a terrorist attack.
Yes.
His impulse was to come back to Washington,
right.
And you said?
I said, I did something I never did again and had never done before. I raised my voice to the President of the United States. I said, stay where you are. You can't come back here. I said, the United States is under attack. And he did stay, of course, and went to an undisclosed location. And I went then to the bunker because the Secret Service, when the Secret Service wants to lead you someplace, they don't so much as lead you as they sort of pick you up and push you in that direction. That day meant that every other day was going to be September 12th.
So you felt in those first moments, again, you mentioned physical security. It wasn't the physical security of the nation. You felt everybody in the White House itself felt physically exposed.
Well, we knew we were physically exposed, but you didn't have time to think about that. You only had to think about the nation. And it's very funny, Peter, you mentioned in the intro that I had been on the White House staff as the Soviet specialist.
Right.
And of course, in those days, everybody prepared for prepared for the possibility of the unthinkable nuclear war. What would you do if the United States was about to experience that decapitating attack? And almost immediately, those impulses kicked in for me on September 11th.
Oh, really?
Yes. And so I went to the bunker. The vice president was there, and he was on the phone with the president getting an unimaginable order to have the Air Force shoot down a civilian aircraft that was not responding. Because, after all, civilian aircraft had now all become potential missiles against the country. And the first thing that I thought was to get in touch with Vladimir Putin and to make sure that the Russians understood that our military forces would be going up on alert so that we didn't get into what was called in the old days a spiral of alerts between the two military forces. And I Putin was actually on the phone trying to reach President Bush, and so I got on with him. I said, the president is not available. He's going to an undisclosed location. But I want you to know our military forces are going on alert. He said, I know ours are coming down. And is there anything else we can do? And I thought, wow, the Cold War really is over. And the other thing that I did was to have the State Department send out a cable to every post in the world to say the United States of America has not been decapitated. We are functioning. And you wanted friend and foe to know that we were not suddenly vulnerable.
From that day, March 2003, when we invaded Iraq, the war went very well for about 3 weeks. In some ways, astonishingly well. Yeah. A rapid march to Baghdad, the fall of Saddam Hussein's government, and then for 4 years, it went, about 4 years, it went badly. This is a book of more than 700 pages. Historians will be writing about it for years to come. But if you put on your cap as an educator, what is the, when the war went wrong, what went wrong?
Well, any big event like war, especially any big event in a country like Iraq that had been so broken by the tyranny of Saddam Hussein, it was going to be hard. And one of the things that I try to dispel in the book is that we thought this was going to be a cakewalk.
Right.
You know, we were somehow going to overthrow Saddam Hussein, and then the Iraqis would greet us as liberators, and it would all be very, very easy. No one thought that. But we did have some faulty assumptions about what would be possible. I think we had faulty assumptions about how solid the institutions, the governmental institutions, were beneath the Ba'athist Saddam Hussein infrastructure. So I can remember, Peter, standing at my desk a few days after the overthrow, the statue had come down,
right,
as everybody
right.
remembers, and saying, where are the oil workers?
Right.
Because they had suddenly just disappeared. The army seemed to disintegrate. The police seemed to disintegrate. All of that civil service that we thought would be able to run the country with new leadership was suddenly not there.
I'm just wondering if you're a Russian expert. Did you think of parallels of the 1917 revolution, how, the way that entire country seemed to dissolve once the Tsar abdicated?
Right.
The opening.
You know, I wish I had. Frankly, I wish I had thought about it. I think we really underestimated how the fabric of a society can be just completely torn apart by a cult of personality like Saddam Hussein.
Mm-hmm.
In many ways, it's not too much of a stretch to say Saddam Hussein was Iraq and Iraq was Saddam Hussein.
Mm.
And so there was very little there. And we found ourselves then in a situation of having to administer the country much more thoroughly than I think we thought would be the case.
Military historian Frederick Kagan quoted in Bob Woodward's book, The War Within, quote, "A reason why Napoleon did so well for so long is because his opponents were having councils of war and Napoleon was just doing stuff." All right. You're a national security advisor through the first term. You're in charge of the councils of war, so to speak. And I'm a layman out here in California. It looked to me the way it looked to a lot of people. Don Rumsfeld at the Pentagon seems to be at sideways of Secretary Powell at the State Department. You've got the CIA. The CIA, I wrote this down, I was so struck. 2003, Daniel Dresner of the New Republic wrote, the CIA is in open revolt. Why did it seem, first of all, what's the substance? Was there dysfunction that ought not to have taken place? Is this simply the kind of thing that you expect when the whole world is being reinvented, when all the assumptions and administration? How do we, again, Rumsfeld, Cheney, Tenet, all these people have their own memoirs out. Some of the passages are a little testy. People still feel a little raw about it. I don't care about that. What's the lesson?
The lesson is that in hard times, personalities will become more what they are, not less what they are. And we had real substantive differences.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is people had different views of how some of this ought to be proceeding. But I think it's a bit of an overstatement to say that the State Department was off doing its own thing in defense. No, the Defense Department had responsibility for post-war reconstruction because the president wanted a single chain of command, unity of command, between the military forces and what was going on the civilian side. And so through the Coalition Provisional Authority under Jerry Bremer, reporting up to Don Rumsfeld, and the military chain reporting up to Don Rumsfeld, the Pentagon had responsibility for this. Now, to be fair to the Pentagon, I don't think anybody had ever undertaken a rebuilding of this magnitude. And the real lesson is, and we got it right by the time of the surge, there are really a couple of lessons. The first is we simply didn't have enough forces on the ground. And so all of the chaos that breaks out shortly after the statue comes down makes it difficult to do even the simplest task of reconstruction. And we simply didn't have enough forces. Secondly, I think it was a bit of an intelligence problem. We did not really fundamentally understand the tribal structures in Iraq. We could have made much better use of the tribes. We could have built Iraq from the outside in instead of from the inside out in the provinces. And the kind of thing that happened with the Anbar Awakening then in 2005 when we made common cause with the sheikhs and really started to get this on a better footing, perhaps that could have happened earlier. But war is like that. As someone said, when you go to war, plans have a tendency to go out of the window, and you're inventing on the ground.
Last question about the lesson of it all. As I said, historians will be writing about this for decades, but for the purposes at this table in front of these cameras today, the surge. This layman's understanding, which I'm sure is crude, corrected if I make a substantive error here, the war's going sideways at best for almost 4 years, and the plan for a surge seems to pop up in a couple of what strike me as odd places. Ludi at the National Security Council was working on a plan for a surge. It seemed to make sense to him. He was quietly building support for it. But one of the places it also seemed to emerge or kind of crystallize was Fred Kagan, then a young military historian, just pulled a few people together and started meeting in the offices of the American Enterprise Institute. They got a retired general, Jack Kane, involved. Jack Kane went to the vice president. It just seems odd that here we have the Pentagon, on which we're spending hundreds of billions of dollars a year, and the war goes sideways under those guys. And the thing that turns it around is this new strategy that pops up almost in a kind of ad hoc fashion.
Well, I think it
wasn't.
It wasn't so ad hoc.
Not ad hoc.
And no,
all right.
No, not at all. And in fact, as the war is going badly in 2006, Steve Hadley goes to the president and says, Mr. President, what we are doing isn't working. We have to do something different. He starts then an internal review. I said to the president.
And Ludi reported to Steve Hadley.
Okay. And I said to the president, things are not going well. We started to look at state and what else we could do. Pete Pace draws together a group of colonels and says, why are these numbers going up on the numbers of
Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Why are these numbers going up on numbers of security forces that we're training and the security situation's getting worse? And so people across the administration are asking questions about what we're doing and can we do something differently? I do think there was some resistance in some corners of the Pentagon to the notion that this might actually mean a doubling down, as some people have put it, on forces. And frankly, I was skeptical on two fronts. And I told the president, it's not that I don't think we should have more troops. I've seen that for a long time. But if we have more troops doing the same thing we've been doing, then we're just going to get more Americans killed. And if the Iraqis are not ready to put aside their own sectarian feuds, blood feuds, then we can't save them from themselves. And so once we were able to satisfy those conditions, and once Bob Gates came to the Pentagon and Petraeus, General Petraeus comes to command, to be the new commander of forces, you begin to get, I think, a Pentagon that sees the war differently. So it's a more logical train. I do think that the outside people like
Fred Kagan and Jack
Kane. Fred Kagan, Jack Kane were important to this, but it would be, I think, not correct to say that this was not, there was no genesis of this in the administration.
All right. Simple last question on Iraq. We invade in 2003. The last troops come home in December 2011. There are different ways of accounting for it. But between those two dates, we spend at least $800 billion. We suffer more than 4,400 killed, more than 31,000 wounded. estimates of Iraqis killed vary widely, but they seem to center on about 100,000. It is an immensely expensive and bloody conflict. Was it worth it?
When you look at Iraq today, you see an Iraq that is still struggling with its new democratic institutions, but that has actually undergone the revolution already that you're seeing in the rest of the Middle East. There's a reason that Iraqi citizens were not out in the streets protesting that their government be overthrown, mm-hmm. as they were in Egypt, as they are in Syria. It's because Iraqis know that that is their representative government. They may not be happy with the electricity that they're providing.
But those purple thumbs mattered.
And secondly, we have succeeded in replacing a homicidal murderer who put 400,000 of his own people in mass graves. You want to talk about a humanitarian disaster. Mm-hmm. Who sought and had used weapons of mass destruction, had invaded his neighbors, was an implacable enemy of the United States. He's been replaced with, admittedly, a fragile government in Iraq that will not invade its neighbors, that will not seek weapons of mass destruction, that will not be a cancer in the Middle East, and will be favorably disposed to the United States, becoming, for instance, the fourth largest purchaser of American military equipment in the Middle East. That's called a strategic trade-up. And in the Middle East, which, after all, was the source from which the hatred that actually brought about the Al-Qaedas of the world, that was a Middle Eastern source. Yeah, it was worth it.
Segment two, rogue states. Condoleezza Rice, during the 2005 hearings, at the end of which the Senate would confirm you as Secretary of State, quote, "the time for diplomacy is now," close quote. Now, in review after review after review of No Higher Honor, reviewers point to that as you're saying, folks, the second term will be different from the first. Did you mean it to be taken quite that dramatically?
I meant it to be taken as a continuum from where we had been. Mm-hmm. After all, I'd been very much a part of the first term, very much a part of the policies of the first term. In no sense was I saying, well, those policies were wrong, now we'll do something different. But we were in a different phase. We had had the wars in Afghanistan and in Iraq. We were now in a phase of what I believe to be the beginning of a consolidation of some of those gains. And in war, it's difficult to think about how to build the diplomatic framework and foundation for what should be sustained going forward. So I thought of it as a continuum.
All right. North Korea, October, I'm going to read to you arguments that I've found in some reviews of the book that frankly attack you from the right.
Yes.
I think you can handle yourself. October 9th, 2006, the North Koreans detonate a nuclear device. President Bush promises a tough response. Steve Hayes, writing in his review of No Higher Honor in the Wall Street Journal, quote, "instead the North Koreans got what they wanted, the attention of the world, a return to the negotiating table with the United States, and the legitimacy that such talks confer," close quote.
What the North Koreans got was a six-party framework with all of the states that might have any chance of doing something about a nuclear program that was progressing. China, Russia, Japan, South Korea. We used the moment of maximum anger at the North Koreans for what they had done in that test to bring those parties together to say to the North Koreans, we now need to have a chance to get a handle on your nuclear program. We need inspectors on the ground. We need you to stop producing the plutonium. We need you to blow up the cooling tower. Because, yeah, we could have made ourselves feel good and sit in Washington and say, yeah, we're going to punish the North Koreans. Mm-hmm. Tell me how we're going to do it.
It was too late.
It was too late.
No military option, not even.
I don't think anybody really believes that there was a serious military option against North Korea with North Korean artillery able to bring tremendous damage to Seoul within a matter of minutes.
Okay, so tell me as a layman, and this is one of those rare questions when I'm not trying to, I actually want to know the answer.
Right.
That's not as rare as I, I'm in your undergraduate class. Here's what happened in North Korea. They tested a nuclear weapon.
Right.
Talks got held, and they still have the nuclear weapon. So how do I know that things are better? How do you judge? What's the alternative history that might have happened?
How do you demonstrate that we did the right thing?
The
alternative history is that we have a crisis with our South Korean ally, for instance, over North Korea, that instead of finding a way to actually cooperate with the Chinese about North Korea, we find ourselves in a crisis with China. Or we find ourselves in a situation in which we actually have no knowledge of what's going on in the North Korean program on the ground. I was struck, Peter, by the fact that if you ask the intelligence agencies prior to our getting on the ground through the six-party talks, what's going on in the North Korean nuclear program, they really knew nothing. The only way to penetrate that opaque, closed society was to actually get people on the ground. And much of what we learned about the troubling developments on the highly enriched uranium side, we learned because the diplomacy had actually gotten inspectors on the ground who were, to put it as one newspaper article put it, crawling all over the North Korean nuclear program. So even if you
At a minimum, we've got extremely valuable information.
At a minimum.
We know what's going on there.
At a minimum, you get information that you get no other way. Now, we could sit in Washington and continue to say, we're not going to deal with them. We're going to continue to sanction them, which, by the way, we didn't remove real sanctions against the North Koreans. They remain the most sanctioned regime in the whole world. But what we did do was take the opportunity to get on the ground, improve our knowledge, slow some of the aspects of their program. And for that, we gave up some fuel oil. That was it.
Okay. Iran. The Bush Doctrine in Iran. The Bush Doctrine, as far as I can tell, it was only used by a person in the administration once. So the Bush Doctrine
because
is the idea.
I don't think President Bush much liked the notion of doctrines.
Anyway, the idea is that we go into Iraq and we say to the world, anybody who wishes us serious harm, we reserve the right to do you harm first. And Dick Cheney did say in June 2003, I'm quoting him, if there's anyone in the world today who doubts the seriousness of the Bush Doctrine, I would urge that person to consider the fate of the Taliban in Afghanistan and of Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq, close quote. Okay, by 2005, we know beyond doubt and in detail that Iran is supporting bad guys in Iraq and in Afghanistan who are killing our troops. And yet that's the year in which we choose to open negotiations with Iran over their nuclear program. And Steve Hayes, I'm quoting him again because Steve throws punches, quote, this decision represented an abandonment of the Bush Doctrine, close quote.
Oh, you know, look, Steve Hayes is a great writer, but Steve Hayes wasn't a policymaker with responsibility for trying to make something happen, and that's the difference. The fact is, if you're dealing with the Iranian
nuclear...
Sort of
point with me, you know. I'm a jabberer
myself.
I'm a member of the
chat. Right.
All we
it's
do is
right.
chatter, but go
it's
ahead.
All right. But if you are trying to actually get a handle on the Iranian nuclear program, if you're actually trying to get not just U.S. sanctions, Iran's heavily sanctioned by the United States, but actually trying to get multilateral sanctions, and I don't mean, by the way, through the U.N., I mean to get the Europeans, for instance, to go along with sanctions. If you're trying to establish that if Iran misbehaves, then the world will, in fact, sanction Iran, then you aren't going to do that by sitting in your corner and saying, well, we'll just carry out our policy the way we want to carry out our policy, and the rest of you do what you want to do. What we did was to say, and it garnered support from the international community, particularly from the Europeans, was to say, all right, we'll make the Iranians a deal. Suspend your nuclear program, suspend your enrichment and reprocessing, and we'll negotiate. The Iranians actually never suspended their program, and so we didn't negotiate. But we did get rounds of sanctions at the UN. We did get what is now continuing and accelerating, financial institutions leaving Iran, companies leaving Iran, the Europeans levering their own sanctions. We don't get that without an offer to negotiate, which, by the way, if the Iranians had taken it up and they had suspended their program, we would have been in very good shape. So what is it
we
that we gave up?
All right.
And one other thing about the Iranians. We did something else that's sometimes not noted. President Bush said, if we catch Iranians in Iraq, any of your agents in Iraq passing technology that might threaten our troops, or they are subject to capture or kill. And we picked up the deputy Quds Force commander, and we took him up to Erbil. And we let it be known that he was up there and he was singing like a little bird. And it's amazing the degree to which the Iranians started to pull in their horns, because they believed that their operations were being compromised. So in addition to making the Iranians an offer that, frankly, I wish they had taken, we were also...
And that cost us very little.
And that cost us nothing. We were in the process of making life pretty miserable for the Iranians inside Iraq.
All right. So you and President Bush start talking with the Iranians in 2005.
We never talked with the Iranians about their nuclear program. What we did do was to allow a couple of meetings at the level of ambassador to say to the Iranians, here's what you're doing, knock it off, or here are the consequences. Mm-hmm. That was the extent of the conversations between Ryan Crocker and his Iranian counterparts.
All right. So engagement, even if only at a very low level, begins in 2005, and here we are at 2012. We're taping this in early February. Late last month, the New York Times ran a heavily reported piece entitled, Will Israel Attack Iran?, in which it quoted Israeli official after official after official, including the defense minister, Ehud Barak, former prime minister, someone you know well and have dealt with repeatedly, and they say this is now a question of months, and they seem to be implying that it's a single-digit number of months before Iran passes the point of, I don't know what to call it, the point at which that North Korea had passed by the time you made the decision to deal with North Korea as you did. That is to say, they acquire a nuclear weapon. Does this mean that all of that diplomacy failed? Again, how do we, that was still, knowing what you know now, that was still the best course for the Bush and the Obama administrations to pursue?
Well, I think you always want to try to make the diplomacy work before you countenance a military action with Iran, which has enormous potential for unintended consequences throughout the region.
Right.
And you don't just use military force as a... People say it should be a last resort. I've never said that, but it certainly isn't the first resort. You try other things. I do think the Iranians are pretty isolated. I think that regime is in pretty deep trouble internally. You see, I suspect, I don't know, but I suspect that a lot of these assassinations and killings are actually internal Iranian politics. And so they're in a worse position now. But it may well be, and President Bush always said, the American president should keep his option for a military strike on the table. And it may well be that the time is approaching when that's going to be a necessity.
All right. Let me ask you, you've just, I feel a little like Chris Matthews, although it wasn't a thrill exactly, it was more of a chill. That's rough for a former Secretary of State to say. A little bit of game theory here. We know that in Congress, completely different matter, but similar in some ways, in Congress, deals get done at the last moment.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Is that likely to be the case in diplomacy? Are the Israelis, in talking to the reporter for the New York Times, is this the kind of thing where years of slow-moving sanctions suddenly get serious? What is likely
to
happen?
Well, I think the sanctions have been getting progressively more serious. I think there's actually more that the Obama administration could do. They should just sanction the central bank. And remember, anytime the United States does something like that, it makes it impossible for any other financial institution to deal with the Iranians.
Because so many capital flows go through
the
United
exactly.
States and take
well,
place in dollars.
Because you then cannot do business with the United States.
Got it.
And so you Got choose it. Between your Iranian business and your U.S. business. That's not a fair fight. But I do think that the Iranians will now say they want to talk. They will say they want a deal. But at this point, we've got them in a corner. At this point, I think the military option is becoming more likely. And at this point, the only deal that you take with the Iranians is total suspension for good.
The military option. You're talking about an attack by Israel, or do you suppose that the Obama administration might countenance an American attack? Direct participation?
I'm not in the councils here as they discuss this. Let me be the first to say the Israelis are not going to ask permission.
Right.
And we should understand
Nor should
that.
They.
Nor should they.
All right. Segment three, the Mideast. In no higher honor, you describe a conversation that you had with President Bush before accepting his appointment as Secretary of State, which I sort of like, the idea that you negotiate with him a little bit before you accept the appointment. Let me quote you, Condi, Secretary Rice. Quote, the one substantive issue that was on my mind was the Mideast. Mr. President, we need to get an agreement and establish a Palestinian state, you said. And the President of the United States replied, quote, we'll get it done, close quote. Now, in the fascinating account that follows, at, to me, a surprising number of points, you write about what is, in essence, your own education. This was the first time I discovered that the Arabs believed this. This was the first time I discovered, or for example, you arrange for the 2007 Annapolis conference, and you write in no higher honor, after years of, quote, begging for a peace conference, the Arabs suddenly had all kinds of reservations, worries, and demands, close quote. So the first question here is, excuse me, I have to include one. You also write about a meeting that you had with Ehud Olmert, who was then the Prime Minister of Israel, who presented to you a proposal that you write about, again, in no higher honor. You call it remarkable and extraordinary. He's ready to offer the Palestinians 94% of the West Bank, make up for the remaining 6% with land swaps, permit them to establish a capital in East Jerusalem, and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas refuses to entertain the offer. Well,
yeah.
So we didn't get a Palestinian
and
state.
And I have to say, I think they wish they'd taken the offer.
Do they really?
Oh, yeah.
I so
think
why
they wish
didn't
they?
The what is the psychology?
The psychology.
The sheer, it strikes one as sheer perversity.
Well, unfortunately, I've said to Peter, this is a it seems to be one of the unluckiest processes in the world.
Mm-hmm.
By the time Olmert makes the offer, unfortunately, he's in political trouble. He's in legal trouble in Israel as a result of the corruption charges.
Yes.
And we tried to, President Bush tried, I tried to prevail upon Abbas and the Palestinians to say, you have an Israeli prime minister on record as being willing to give you a capital in Jerusalem. You may never see that day again. I don't care if he's in trouble. Take it. I think there were actually Israelis who were telling them, you'll get a better deal if you wait until the elections are over. Remember also that we were close to an election in the United States. They may well have thought, well, we'll have a Democratic administration, maybe they'll be willing. It was sheer folly. It was a terrible mistake. Abbas himself has said
that. So these were highly intelligent people,
yes,
on the Arab side,
yes,
who knew what they were dealing,
right,
doing, wanted a deal, but made a series of specific miscalculations.
I think that's
right. That's all. It's not a kind of sheer boneheadedness or perversity.
No, it's not. Although I did say to President Abbas, who I personally like quite a bit, I said, you know, you should have taken the deal in 48. You should have taken the deal in 67. You should have taken the deal in 2000. Now take the deal, because every time you don't take the deal, you're state gets smaller. And the frustration, actually, was, yes, with the Palestinians. But the truth of the matter is we left this entire negotiating record for the Obama administration. And they decided that they didn't want to continue on that path. They wanted to start over. They wanted to insist that the Israelis have a settlement freeze. No Israeli prime minister, I don't care where he or she is on the political spectrum,
mm-hmm,
can agree to a settlement freeze.
Mm-hmm.
And once the Americans wanted a settlement freeze, now Abbas can't be less Palestinian than the Americans, and this whole thing then goes off, and we're in worse shape now than we've been in the Israeli-Palestinian issue for maybe a couple of decades.
Okay, so here's a layman's response. Read all of this. It's absolutely fascinating. But this book belongs on a shelf with George Shultz's book, Henry Kissinger's couple of volumes, the amount of intelligence, treasure, American prestige that we have invested in attempting to achieve some kind of settlement in the Middle East, isn't it the case that when it comes right down to it, we've got a workable peace, and it's ensured by the Israeli Defense Forces and the United States Sixth Fleet? Why not just leave it alone for a decade?
Well, because in the long run, I don't think it's sustainable. It's not sustainable for demographic reasons. It's not sustainable because Israelis and Palestinians shouldn't have to live that way. You know, I watched so many times rocket fire coming out of Gaza and the Israeli citizens scrambling into bomb shelters. I watched so many times innocent Palestinians mm-hmm. with women dying in childbirth or children dying because they can't cross a checkpoint that takes too long. You know, people shouldn't have to live that way. And there are, I think, still very strong reasons for a two-state solution. But you're right that it's not going to happen because the United States wants it. It's only going to happen because the Israelis and the Palestinians finally come to an agreement. And the sad thing is, many people blame the Israelis. I have to say, I think that it's been the Palestinians who've more often walked away from deals than the Israelis.
I want to talk about the Arab Spring in a moment from the point of view of the future of the Arab world. But the immediate effect, again, I put this is an assertion in the form of a question. The immediate effect of the Arab Spring is to replace Mubarak, a regime for which no one shed tears, but that more or less abided by the Camp David peace agreement and kept the Sinai out of play in a military sense, to replace Mubarak with a new regime. It's now emerging. The Muslim Brotherhood is powerful. The Egyptian army is powerful. Whatever is the case, it's less certain. And now that long border of the Sinai becomes a military problem, doesn't it? Hasn't the immediate effect of the Arab Spring on Israel, isn't it to complicate their situation enormously?
No, the immediate effect has certainly been to complicate the situation of the Middle East in general and Israel in particular, yes. But the assumption is that there was another option. Mm-hmm. The problem is authoritarianism isn't stable in the long run. And we tried, through what came to be called the Freedom Agenda, to get our friends to understand that they should start to reform before their people were in the streets. That was the idea behind the Cairo speech that I gave in June mm-hmm. 2005. It was my conversation with Mubarak. Before your people are in the streets, give them reforms. Allow them to have a voice. Don't make the only strong political institutions in the country the Muslim Brotherhood, because they can operate and organize in the radical mosques and the radical madrasas while you hound decent political forces out of the public square. Don't allow this freedom gap mm-hmm. to produce even more radical forces.
And the president of Egypt replied,
"You don't know my country. My people don't like foreign interference, and they need a strong hand. It's me or the Muslim Brotherhood." And then he engaged in policies that made it so. Mm. And it's too bad, because, as you say, Mubarak did a lot of good things. Bin Ali did a lot of good things. But these authoritarian regimes are not stable in the modern world, where either people are going to be given a chance to exercise their rights, or they're going to take the rights.
Special case. Authoritarian regime, close ally of the United States, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, we know, has been funding madrasas. If you had to say, what is the financial source most directly responsible for the rise of radical Islam, it would be Saudi Arabia. And yet, we know that perhaps one of the most successful diplomats in Washington in the last half century was Prince Bandar
yes.
of Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
We know that the Bush family in particular felt a certain closeness to Prince Bandar and to the Saudi royal family. And there is that photograph of the South President Bush on the Truman Balcony, I think it's called, a couple of days after September 11th, having a chat with Prince Bandar. I don't get it. Why are those folks still our allies?
Well,
and why can't we get them to knock off the misbehavior, well, which has been going on for decades?
Well,
it's obviously complicated.
Right. It's complicated. The United States isn't an NGO, right? So sometimes we have to deal with regimes with which we don't actually share values, but we might share interests. But Saudi Arabia is an interesting tell because you are absolutely right. Prior to 9/11, the Saudis made a kind of, the House of Saud made a kind of Faustian bargain after the 1978-79 events in Iran.
Right.
They saw the power of religion there. And so they kind of made a deal. All right, the politics will be ours, and the ulema, or the religious groups, the religious clerics, will have control of religious thought and so forth. And this kind of philosophy, Wahhabism, which is the most an extreme
radical
form
extreme,
of Islam, they allowed to be exported. The madrasas were built. It wasn't always the government of Saudi Arabia. It was very often wealthy families who were exporting this. And then it came back to haunt them. Because it turns out that Al-Qaeda, which is then born of that atmosphere, Al-Qaeda's great hope was to overthrow what they considered the corrupt regime of the House of Saud by driving the United States out of the Middle East. And so all of a sudden, this Faustian bargain comes back to haunt them. And I can tell you that when there's an attack on the kingdom in May of 2003 in Riyadh, they suddenly realize what has happened to them. And Saudi Arabia then becomes a pretty fierce fighter in the war on terrorism. I think any terrorism expert, anybody who was actually trying to do this, will tell you the Saudis became pretty good at the counterterrorism
indispensable
business.
To us? How would you grade them? They
I would
are
say
indispensable.
Indispensable to us. Now, the regime still needs to make reforms. The king, I think, is actually, within his own very conservative context, a kind of reformer. He's someone who receives women, who's someone who's actually said women will one day have the right to vote. I know this sounds pretty...
I'm very happy because I can remember,
right?
You're mentioning this, right. I can remember that you got to wear a magnificent dress when you were presented all the way down to your ankles,
yeah,
as I recall.
Yes, but this is the king of Saudi Arabia saying, well, women will vote, and receiving women to hear their views and building a university that is going to be a technical university, not a university given over to just religious thought. So in his own context, he's something of a reformer. The problem is he's 88 years old or whatever he is. I don't think that there are particularly good options after he dies, and one has to worry then about the future of Saudi Arabia. I would hope that these monarchies, not just in Saudi Arabia, but in Jordan, in Morocco, would find a way to become more constitutional monarchies, give real authority to the parliaments. They actually are pretty popular, these monarchs.
But you've got a message for them, but you also have a message for us, which is the world beyond our shores is a remarkably difficult and nasty place. And it's so difficult and so nasty that one of our best friends and indispensable ally is this strangely medieval, rich with petrodollar kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
Yes, yes. But I would also say to us, the reason the United States has been so important to the international to the international system is that we have always been willing to deal with the world as it is.
Right.
But we've had a very strong vision of the world as it ought to be. Great powers that want to imprint a set of values on the international system, great powers that have a view of how human history ought to unfold, those are the great powers that ultimately really matter. And the United States, particularly since World War II, has had a view that as democracy spreads, as freedom spreads, even if it's in the short term difficult, in the long term it's going to be so much better. And my concern, as I sit here in 2012, is that the United States doesn't have an option to go to the sidelines and say, all right, we're done with that work of trying to make the world as it should be, not just as it is. Because one of two things will happen. Either there will be chaos, or somebody else will take up that work.
And when the British Empire collapsed, they had us to hand it over to.
That's right.
We have no one to hand it over to.
No, and the most likely outcome is that the next major imprinter on the international system is somebody who doesn't believe in a balance of power that favors freedom. And that would be very bad for us.
All right, let me get to a couple of those likely successors, should we choose to let them succeed us. Segment four, Russia and China. Russia first. You're a Russian expert. You speak the language. You devoted your early academic life to the study of this country. You made it your professional calling in the White House during the administration of the first President Bush. 1991, you're in the White House. In 1991, when the Soviet Union ceases to exist and Boris Yeltsin, a democratically elected president, arranges quickly to spread democracy through the Russian Federation, for the first time in 1,000 years of Russian history, democracy suddenly blossoms and the economy contracts and alcoholism shoots up and living standards shrink. What went wrong?
Well, I'm not really sure that one can call what happened democracy. You know, we have to remember, when totalitarians fall, tyranny is ended. Freedom breaks out. But democracy is not the same thing as freedom. Democracy is the institutionalization of freedom. Democracy is the building of rule of law. The reliable institutions that people can actually depend on to defend their freedom.
Private property, independent judiciary,
property rights that are considered to be actually equal in sense of access. What happened, I think, in Russia was, unfortunately, first of all, was the privatization of a lot of Russian assets into people's pockets, who became, many of them, the oligarchs. There was a breakdown of state institutions, and Vladimir Putin is a direct result of that. Because I used to go to Russia a lot after I left the government in 92, 93, mm-hmm. 94, and you would go, and we were trumpeting and heralding the new democracy in Russia, the great freedoms in Russia, and you would go, and the Russian people were feeling humiliation, deprivation, and chaos. There were drive-by shootings.
They actually wanted a strong man.
They believed they needed something to, and Putin comes to power in 99 and he says, I will give you stability, I will give you respect, and I will give you prosperity.
And 2 out of 3 ain't bad.
And for a while he does. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, he moves from being arrogant to megalomaniacal. But in the meantime, the Russians do get a sense of stability. They get more personal freedoms than at any other time in their history. But that institutionalization of freedom, the rule of law, the independent judiciary, the independent press, all of that is run over by Vladimir Putin and his drive to bring order.
Well, okay, so how bad is he really? If you've got 1,000 years of authoritarianism and 70 years of totalitarianism. Putin comes along, the situation is chaotic, he reasserts strongman government, but even if it's only pro forma, even if it's only in a kind of silly observance of the letter of the Constitution, he does step down from the presidency at the end of his right. 2 terms. Big deal?
Yes.
It is.
But then he undid it. And by the way, angered the Russian people. You see, the Russian people, I think, had actually begun to believe that maybe there was something to these democratic institutions that
they
had.
This might work out.
When I first went to Russia in 1979 to do language training, Russians wouldn't look you in the eye. They looked at their feet. They were terrified of their government. They were terrified of everything. Several decades later, this is a different Russia. Russians travel. They do speak out. They're not so fearful anymore.
Okay. So here are the large strategic problems that Russia faces over decades. A rising China and pressure all along their southern tier from an energized and in some cases radical Islam. Same problems
yes.
we face. Why can't we be friends?
Well, in fact, on most global issues, we were kind of friends. The truth is that this notion that relations were so bad with the Russians in the Bush administration simply isn't true. We had very good cooperation on North Korea. We had excellent cooperation, actually, on terrorism. The fact is, Putin saw very early on that the Al-Qaeda fight we could somehow cooperate if we could understand that he had a similar problem in the South. And while we didn't want to be associated with the repression of Chechens, the truth is that the Chechens were in
some pretty bad company. Bad actors.
And so on terrorism, we did very well. On a number of issues, we did very well. Nuclear proliferation, we did very well. The Russians helped us with the India civil nuke deal, lots of things. When we ran into trouble with the Russians, it was on two fronts. Mm-hmm. Democratization in Russia itself, because Putin didn't like the notion that the ultimate answer to the end of terrorism was freedom and democracy. That wasn't in the script from his point of view. Exactly.
Right, all right.
And the other was whenever we dealt with the periphery, or what they consider to be the former Soviet Union or the former Russian Empire, so Georgia, Ukraine. That's when we or putting missile defense in Poland and
they still
the Czech
felt it was
Republic.
Theirs.
It was theirs. And how dare we encroach? And we had a different view. These were independent states. They had a right to pick their friends. They had a right to choose their military strategies, et cetera.
So that's inherently Russian. Russians are always going to feel proprietorial toward Georgia to the south and Poland to the west.
These Russians.
So could that change? Is that a generational change?
Well, I have a sense that younger Russians don't, for the most part, don't have the same attachment. But I'll tell you something. One of the slightly disturbing things about what is currently going on in Russia, where we're watching a challenge to Putinism, where mm-hmm. we're watching Russians express that they really didn't like the fact that he stood up one day and said, oh, I think I'll be president again, and oh, by the way, it'll be another 16 years before you get anybody else. Some of that opposition, though, is coming from pretty hardcore nationalist forces. And it may well be that the first implication, the first wave against Putinism will not come from liberal democratic forces, or as the Russians call them, right forces, right-wing forces. They have the reversed spectrum. But from these left forces, nationalists,
Mother Russia,
communists, and the like.
China. I'm trying to find some, give you an opportunity to cheer us all up here. In 2008, I'll ask you about China through a passage in No Higher Honor. 2008, you visited China after a massive earthquake. I'll quote you. We had to pass through a village on the way to the relocation camp. It was right out of the 19th century, just a few miles from the gleaming modern metropolis of Chengdu. That's the problem, I thought. They've pulled more than 500 million people out of poverty, but they have so many more to go. And inequality is widening. How does a Marxist government handle that? Close quote. Well, how are they handling it?
Not very well, I would say. Because the Chinese government has based its legitimacy on prosperity. Its legitimacy based on prosperity. And that's hard because eventually people's expectations start growing and it's a little bit tough to keep up with rising expectations. And when they go to this 2012 Party Congress, you have to think that there are people in those halls who are saying, is this ultimately stable? You're starting to get anger against the people called the princelings. These are the grandchildren of the revolutionaries who now drive around in Ferraris. You're getting people who are unhappy that their land is being confiscated by developers, and you're actually having the overthrow of local communist officials as a result. And there have got to be people saying, and I think this is why Wen Jiabao started talking about, well, maybe we need political reform as well. People who are saying, you know, before this prosperity or legitimacy based on prosperity runs out, should we be looking at something else? Is there even a pathway to legitimacy based on consent without becoming Gorbachev?
Mm-hmm.
Because every communist leader ends with that phrase, without becoming Gorbachev. Who tried to reform, and the whole thing collapsed.
Okay, so China, we've been talking about 1,000 years of Russian history. There's a lot more, recognizably Chinese history. But what you get is the, broadly speaking, over those many centuries, a certain contentedness to be the Middle Kingdom.
Yeah.
It's not expansionist, like you start with a little duchy of Kiev and you end up with a country that stretches across two continents. It's not expansionist in the same way.
It hadn't been.
So, okay, so the question is, this Chinese history that's not expansionist plus their internal problems, do we get a pass with China? Are they going to be our we don't.
I don't think so because there will be challenges. First of all, because I would say that Chinese foreign policy is mercantilist at this point, which is just the wild search for resources in support of Chinese economic growth. In Africa, in Latin America, you see the Chinese everywhere after
Australians
these resources.
Australians are doing very well out of it.
Right. But the Australians can defend themselves in that sense. In Africa, this has a different character, where the Chinese are willing to deal with any old corrupt African regime, and that's not doing very well for Africans who are actually starting to emerge from these corrupt regimes. But I think the real question with China is not will they somehow overtake us. I'm quite confident that China has a very, very long way to go. They are experiencing a lot of internal tensions, and that any country that is as terrified of the internet as they are, hacking into people's servers to find one last human rights advocate out in Xinjiang, that country isn't going to lead the knowledge-based revolution. So I don't see that kind of challenge from China. And I'm also confident that if we don't do something stupid in terms of our own military capability, then we're going to be able to check China militarily or strategically. The real question is how internally the United States deals with our own difficulties so that we're strong enough and confident enough and optimistic enough to continue to lead.
Okay, last segment, then and now, no higher honor. In May 2011, the United States finally got bin Laden. I felt a great sense of relief and pride, as well as gratitude to President Obama for the bold decision to launch the raid that led to that killing. And I felt vindication for putting into place many of the tools that had led to that day, close quote. Now that one passage is worth pondering, in my opinion. First of all, why did you feel relieved? Did bin Laden still represent a threat, or was it just a hanging, unfinished piece of business?
Well, I think he represented the face of the soul of al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is not today the organization that it was on September 11th. I've always felt that when we killed a lot of, or captured or killed a lot of their field generals, people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, which was like getting Rommel in the middle of the war,
right,
that we really weakened that organization. And every successive generation of leadership was not as good as the former. And so they, I'm quite sure, aren't capable of carrying out a 9/11. They can still get lucky. They can still do small attacks. So it wasn't that we needed to get bin Laden for those reasons. But al-Qaeda, the soul of al-Qaeda, has now died, has now been killed. And with the Arab Spring, the sense that somehow al-Qaeda had an answer to how to deal with these corrupt regimes is also made to a lie. And so the organization is now tremendously weakened.
You touched on something that I want to make explicit. Back during the Cold War, we placed all kinds of pressures on this. There were proxy wars, economic pressures, diplomatic pressures. In the war with radical Islam that began on September 11th, 2001, we killed a lot of people, and there's no way around it. That, in your judgment, was necessary.
Absolutely.
All right. That's the kind of thing undergraduates need to pay
attention
to.
Because this wasn't, just to expound for one moment, this wasn't a law enforcement action.
Right.
This was a war. I actually had this discussion with my undergraduates a couple weeks ago in class, and we talked about the war terminology.
I think we can safely say you're the only former Secretary of State now teaching undergraduates. Go ahead.
I said to them, why the war? And they said, well, was it a metaphor? I said, no. It said, did you think about what they did? They went after the financial center of the country. They went after the military nerve center of the country. They were going after either the White House or the Capitol.
They tried to kill Professor Rice.
They tried to kill the government and the authority of the United States. They went after the integrity of the state. That's war. This isn't just some criminal action. So that's why when you think about killing their field generals, it was very critical.
All right. Why was President Obama's decision bold? Part of this has to do with Pakistan, doesn't it?
Some of it has to do with Pakistan. And also, I'm quite sure that they were telling him, well, there's a, pick a number, 50%, 60% right. chance that he's there. There's a chance that this could go the way of the rescue effort in Iran, which went so badly. And presidents are looking at, when they are these presentations are made, they're looking at every bad possibility. And right. yet he said, let's do it. That's what presidents should do.
All right. And now this point you make, I felt vindication for putting into place many of the tools that
yes.
led to that day.
Because,
name those tools.
Because he would not have had that opportunity for a bold decision if we had not had the information that we gleaned from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed through enhanced interrogation. He would not have had the drones that were able to establish the whereabouts. He would not have had the intelligence network, and he would not have had the military and intelligence cooperation so thoroughly and completely integrated in the way that they were without the decisions that George W. Bush took in 2001.
All right. Former Attorney General Michael Mukasey, your colleague on the Bush cabinet, writing in the Wall Street Journal shortly after the raid that killed bin Laden, quote, "But policies put in place by the very administration that presided over this splendid success, that is the Obama administration, promise fewer such successes in the future," close quote. So the question that cannot be avoided, has Barack Obama, the man who boldly sent in the special force to kill bin Laden, made the United States safer, or has he undone some of the important work of the Bush administration?
Well, I think he has actually kept in place most of the important work of the Bush administration.
Gitmo is still open.
Gitmo is still open, and turns out it's very hard to close it. The surveillance programs on the Patriot Act are still in place. I do think that there is a bit of a law enforcement mentality creeping back in. Mm-hmm. But when you find that they are willing to use drones,
Far more than your administration did.
To take out an American citizen. By the way, Al-Awlaki was a bad guy, and it was the right thing to do. But, you know, the same administration, the Obama administration, who said, oh, the terrible things that the Bush administration did in the name of the war on terrorism, you know, this is pretty far out there as a decision without, quote, due process or trial. To blow away a terrorist from the sky. And so actually, I think they have sustained most of the programs, but to the degree that a little bit of a law enforcement mentality starts to creep in, like the very ill-fated decision to, quote, try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in the city of New York, one of the most ridiculous notions I think I've heard.
It took them about, what, 48 hours to
back
down?
Yeah, to back
that.
Down.
Right.
But I think to the degree that that starts to creep in, to the degree that you start to think that a terrorist is just like a suspect that you're going to Mirandize and give all of the, then you start to get into trouble. Because it may not be Al-Qaeda to do another 9/11, but there will be a terrorist, there is a terrorist threat out there, and one day they might get lucky if you don't have sufficient information to stop them.
Okay, so we're in an election year, presidential election year, and it sounds to me as though I want to separate very sharply the direct defense of the nation from the question you mentioned a moment ago when we were discussing China, which is to say how we will behave handling our own domestic problems. First, the direct defense of the nation. It sounds to me as though if Barack Obama were reelected next November, that might not be your ideal outcome, but you don't feel that the nation would be placed at threat during those 4 years.
Well, I think presidents of the United States tend to act in a certain way when the country's threatened. But let me say this. I think that the idea that somehow the United States doesn't have a special role in the world, that somehow the United States is just like any country, we're not really exceptional. You know, we're going to do everything through the UN.
You find that offensive,
don't
you?
Yeah, I do find it offensive. Because if you want to tell the American people they're not exceptional, then tell them why they ought to continue to bear the burdens of international leadership. Why not just let somebody else do it? I think leading from behind is an oxymoron. And I do think that there's a sense out there somehow that the United States is not really respected these days. It's one thing. I said, I don't like the North Koreans. I'd rather that the North Korean regime were gone. But yeah, I actually have to try and get a handle on their nuclear program. That's different than saying, you know, I'm going to engage the North Koreans. Or I might have to offer the Iranians to sit down and talk about their nuclear program if they're prepared to suspend. But, you know, I'm not actually going to reach out a hand of friendship to the Iranians so that they can bite it off, as they did President Obama. And I'm not going to hug Hugo Chavez at the first Summit of the Americas with Lula and Uribe standing there, who actually are American friends.
Guys who really put themselves at risk to be friends to the
United
States.
Really put themselves at risk. I'm going to know the difference between our friends and our foes. I'm going to know that putting Israel in a position where we begin to question whether or not what they're doing is legal somehow in the international system in the building of settlements, I'm not going to put that kind of distance between myself and the one true democracy in the Middle East.
Okay, I have only two more questions because, frankly, because I know that you have to get someplace else. Yeah. But here's the penultimate question. For a former Secretary of State, you sure like democracy.
Yeah.
I found myself thinking several times during our conversation that you're nothing at all like George Kennan, whose writings throughout his extremely long career, what was he, 102 when he died, but again and again you see him bristling that diplomacy isn't left to the professionals, that the politicians keep coming in with their huge oafish feet and stamping on the delicate work of the professionals. In Henry Kissinger, who I think would have to rank among the great secretaries of state, but again and again you get the feeling in the memoirs that all of this would have been easier if the Secretary of State had had a professional corps of aristocrats the way Bismarck did to handle the diplomacy for him. And, you know, you don't seem to have even, you've described that the difficulties that achieving a settlement in the Middle East, part of the problem you felt was that Israel had an election coming up and then we had an election. Democracy got in the way. You could have cut a deal, maybe. I get that. But you don't mind.
No. Because if I think about what democracy has led to in the long arc of history, I think, would anybody have believed a couple hundred years ago, maybe 100 years ago, that France and Germany wouldn't actually fight again? Would anybody have believed that Latin America, which was supposedly given over to Condillos, would actually have strong democracies like Brazil or Colombia? Would anybody have believed that even in places like Africa, you would begin to have a demand that people hold their governments accountable? And I believe we're going to be saying that about the Middle East one day. Because, it's really kind of troubling right now when you see a Hezbollah or a Muslim Brotherhood. But, you know, ultimately, if their electoral slogan is elect us and we'll make your kids suicide bombers and impose Sharia law, I don't think they're going to do so well. And so I understand that the real gift or the real genius of democracy is that it gives men and women a way to resolve their differences peacefully. And if they get too mad and too angry, they can throw the bombs out peacefully. And no other form of government provides that. And therefore, no other form of government is ultimately stable.
Last question. Claire Booth Luce, diplomat, congresswoman, journalist, playwright, used to say that history would give even the greatest figures only one sentence. Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation and freed the slaves. Churchill defeated Hitler. What is the one sentence for George W. Bush?
That freedom is an inalienable right of every man, woman, and child, and that we have to look to end tyranny.
Condoleezza Rice, former Secretary of State, Hoover Institution Fellow, and teacher of undergraduates at Stanford University, and the author most recently of No Higher Honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm Peter Robinson for Uncommon Knowledge. Thanks for joining us.